Friday seems to come around so quickly, more and more as the year progresses. Good to have you along. This is Let's Talk. I'd like to begin firstly by acknowledging traditional owners of the land where Let's Talk is broadcast. I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders, both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders and non-Indigenous elders. This is, of course, Let's Talk, live from the studios of 98.9 FM in Brisbane, broadcast across the country on the National Indigenous Radio Service. So good day if you're listening here or outside of Brisbane. Well, on July 1st, a commission of inquiry was established to review the state's child protection system. The commission is headed by Senior Counsel Tim Carmody and is expected to report back to the Newman government in late April 2013. The commission is conducting hearings across the state. They're currently in Cairns. In the past fortnight, it's conducted hearings here in Brisbane. And one of the people giving evidence at the Brisbane hearings was William Haywood, who's a law and justice advocacy development officer with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service. William, welcome to Let's Talk.
Thanks, Karen.
Firstly, tell us your mob, your country, William.
I'm a Noongar man from the Minangurang Nations, basically around Katanning through to Bremer Bay area. And the Haywood farmer and Coyne families are our mob. So a big shout out to all those Noongars out over there.
And they'll be all getting ready for the finals with the AFL, I suppose. You're all AFL followers, I guess?
Yep, absolutely. I'll be going for the Dockers in Geelong.
Okay, good-o. How do you reckon they'll go?
I hope they do well this year, yeah.
Okay, yep. Rightio. Tell us, how did the East Coast entice a West Australian boy over this way?
My sister was actually in the armed forces, and I visited for a holiday when I was 19. Decided to actually enrol in uni and spend some time here, and have never looked back. And I did, as a Noongar, I did get very homesick and miss that connection with people and family. But over time, I've really made this my home and have been blessed with strong connection and friends and, important, significant people who, culturally have taken me in and look after me over here in Queensland. So very happy.
So how long have you been in Queensland then, William?
About 10 years.
10 years?
Yeah.
Would you still call yourself a WA boy?
Well, I think I've been turned mainly by the Maroons and half the team being Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. So I think I'm an honorary Queenslander in that regard. And very much this has become my home. So
okay. All right. And so you follow rugby league now too?
Yeah, I do.
I bet you don't talk too much about that when you go back home.
No, it's not on very often.
No.
It's a very strong AFL town.
Mm. Yeah. What did you study here in Brisbane?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to study at two universities. I did half my social work degree at the University of Queensland, and then the other half at James Cook University. So I had a nice balance of two universities with strong social work practices and courses. So it was a good foundation. I think the James Cook University offered some good insight into the Cape, the Gulf, and also the Torres Strait social work practices, which was great.
And so did you study at a campus here in Brisbane, or did you go to the Townsville, to the main campus, when you went to James Cook?
I actually studied through external studies and continued to work and had great support there from the School of Social Work. I'd actually encourage people in child protection who might be at paraprofessional level to really consider looking at James Cook University and other unis that offer external studies and can support people while they carry on with their work and family commitments, because it's also about raising our skill levels and capability to take ownership of issues in child protection as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals and ultimately as community.
So were you doing social work as you were studying social work?
Yeah, I in some ways, towards the end of the degree, it was about getting that formal piece of paper, and had very much become accustomed with social work practices with families and children, but also blending that with a strong cultural foundation. So I highly value the knowledge and frameworks that I've learnt from social work. But I think that I was meant to sort of work in that area of work because it's been a complementary framework with areas that I've really been passionate about, particularly children and young people, and supporting their families to support our children to reach their full potential.
Mm. Well, right now you're the Law and Justice Advocacy Development Officer with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service. And so I guess one of your focuses is child protection?
Yeah, I've had a strong career since 1999, commencing as a youth worker with the Department of Families in Western Australia. Also, cultural retention and preservation programs through the Wardandi Cultural Centre in Injunup, in the southwest of WA, for children who had linkages to youth justice and child protection. And then in Queensland, commenced with a cadetship and a number of roles in front line, and then policy within the Department of Child Safety. Then I was privileged to serve the community at the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Child Protection Peak.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've gone across to ATSL's as the Law and Justice Advocacy Development Officer. So with the focus on the inquiry and the high need because of the rates of overrepresentation, Shane Duffy, the CEO, and the Board of Directors have made a strong commitment to child protection, so it's worked quite nicely, that experience, and then coming across to ATSL's. And ultimately, that dialogue and law reform possibilities are really benefiting our children and young people.
So when you were with the Peak Protection, that was mainly sort of policy. Here with ATSL's, you're dealing with reform, law reform. Which do you, and before that, you're obviously working, you know, in the front line, working with young people. I guess it's probably like comparing chalk and cheese, isn't it? They all, I guess, in a way, complement each other. But which do you find, and I don't want to put you in a position here, but what did you like the most?
I think I've always had a commitment to stay connected with frontline service delivery, because ultimately that's what informs policy and legislation development. And I find that I like both equal, and I'm lucky that both at the Queensland Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Peak and now at ATSL's, I do deliver a advisory function for complex cases, both within the community controlled sector for child protection, and more recently supporting lawyers in legal representation for families, particularly where we feel that there's a possibility that through a diversion to a support service that children and young people could be supported, better supported at home rather than statutory out-of-home care. So those types of complex cases, I'm still able to have some influence and stay connected to frontline practice, and that informs positions around law reform and policy and practice development, which is a good connection and a good balance for me.
Mm. So when you heard that Campbell Newman was going to establish this inquiry into the child protection system in Queensland, what was your reaction?
I was actually relieved, and I welcomed the opportunity that the inquiry presents. Whilst working with previous ministers in the Labor government, also had a relationship with the opposition party and a number of shadow ministers. And I think that the conversations that occurred with those shadow ministers prior to the Newman government being elected, certainly that they have demonstrated a willingness to look at overrepresentation and the strategies that are required to address overrepresentation with an open mind and a willingness to actually shift and change the system. And so I've really welcomed this opportunity and am quite optimistic that this government will look seriously at overrepresentation, and they have actually named that in the terms of reference and an area that they're seeking recommendations from the Commission from. So it's a great opportunity, and it's important that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals in government and non-government seek to inform the inquiry around their positions, particularly solutions within child protection.
Tell us, what are the statistics? So when we talk about over-representation, how bad is it, William?
It is very bad. I think that it needs to be recognised that the low socioeconomic status of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and also intergenerational trauma from past policies and practices, directly contribute to the breakdown of the family unit and the stresses upon families. So that's overarching, and that's influencing the rates of overrepresentation. The main harm and risk indicators are domestic violence, substance misuse and parenting capacity, and often neglect overarches those main harm and risk indicators. I think that we need to look at the dynamic of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families from a parallel process, incorporating and taking into consideration the impacts of history and breaking and the solutions to break those intergenerational cycles, but also importantly address the immediate child protection concerns. So currently the rates of overrepresentation is 37.7%.
Right.
But it is actually predicted to hit 60% by the department.
60%?
Yes, in 2014. And, you know, we have to accept that that's unacceptable and that that should not occur. So the inquiry is a welcome blessing for Aboriginal people, where it's seriously looking at strategies to address overrepresentation.
And that would seem to indicate that things are getting worse for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families, not better.
Yeah. I think that the strategies such as closing the gap are going to take time, and so we'll see improvements in future generations. And so I think there needs to be some acceptance that we need to invest in the future generations, particularly children and young people, to see that shift over time. So it must be viewed as a social investment, which ultimately will, you know, reduce those social and economic costs in future generations, because it is growing and it is getting worse. So the inquiry is a great opportunity to shift that focus and to look more proactively and innovatively at strategies to address that. So whilst we wait for closing the gap to take effect, and there's some great work that's occurring across states and territories there, we also need a balanced child protection response with universal awareness and education programs that really raise the understanding within our communities about harm, about risk, and about strategies that keep children safe, and how to build resilience and protective factors within community. Also having access to early intervention services such as intensive family support services, and that those services, their capacity is built in terms of the amount of families that they can engage and support. And then also while universal and early intervention is allowed to take effect, having strong statutory assistance for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families to be diverted out and exit the statutory or child safety system with the appropriate therapeutic and family-focused responses, as well as keeping children central in that work.
Can the state afford it, though? I mean, we hear about Campbell Newman talking about the state's finances and the mess, basically, that Labor left us in. Can you know what you're talking about there? It all, you know, sounds like it will cost a fair bit.
Yeah, it's an appropriate consideration. And first and foremost, I would actually agree with the Newman government that it is unsustainable, that we can't continue to look at band-aid approaches within the statutory response. And it certainly isn't in children and young people's best interest to be removed from their families, not just immediate family, but the broader extended family and community. So I think a shift within the statutory system, which may include diversion of resources to some of the more appropriate areas that assist and support families prior to statutory involvement, so the universal and early intervention approaches would actually see over time the pressure on the statutory system be alleviated. But most importantly, with a strength-based empowerment approach, the concept is that families aren't dependent on the early intervention family support services, but are supported to take ownership of issues that they may be faced with and the challenges that they face as a family, and to have strong strategies to actually you know, be empowered to live and protect their children and reach their full potential outside of any statutory or early intervention approach.
You're listening to Let's Talk, coming to you from the studios of 98.9 FM in Brisbane, broadcast on the National Indigenous Radio Service. My name is Karen Durante, and you're listening to Let's Talk. William Haywood is our guest today. He's the Law and Justice Advocacy Development Officer with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service. We'll come back to our conversation with William in just a moment. Archie Roach with his song, I guess, about the stolen generation and those removal policies that existed, took the children away. You're listening to Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service, Ed on 98.9 FM. William Haywood is with us. He's the Law and Justice Advocacy Development Officer with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service. Recently gave evidence at the Child Protection Commission of Inquiry into the state's child protection system. And William, I heard that you had to clarify a statement that you made about the stolen generations. What was that about?
Yeah, I felt responsible to really make it clear to the Commission, particularly because of mainstream media sensationalising some of my comments. So ultimately, the past policies and practices that oppressed and controlled Aboriginal people, including the stolen generation, do have intergenerational impact. So the trauma, the grief and loss is proven to be transferred through generations. And so that impact of trauma and grief and loss, alongside the low socioeconomic status and poverty, which can be directly linked to those practices and history, should be understood and considered as a element, so a part of the root causes of overrepresentation. But it must be balanced with a child protection response that looks at the immediate needs and risks within a family, and so responding to those child protection concerns with consideration of some of the overarching dynamics that might be influencing families, the reality is that we work with children and young people and families who do have direct linkages through descendants or personally to the stolen generation. So not to incorporate that in to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander child protection practice would be a deficiency. And so that balanced approach of healing in terms of intergenerational trauma, grief and loss, and utilising culture and healing as a tool for positive change alongside appropriate child protection responses would be of great benefit to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
So what was exactly said, though, that it needed to be clarified? Because that makes sense there, just listening to what you've just said.
Yeah, I feel that the Commission of Inquiry understood my position.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I woke up and on the way to work I read an article and in mainstream media. And sections of my statement had been taken and it was, I guess, sensationalising the linkage to the stolen generation.
Mm.
And
what was it basically saying, that this is another stolen generation or something like that? I didn't actually quite see that article.
Rather than giving the balanced position that most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals see and practice within a practice framework, having that balanced child protection plus an understanding of history as some of the influence and root cause of the issues we face, the media had portrayed that through sections of my comments that, you know, basically presenting that it's all about the stolen generation. It is a major influence, but it's a parallel process that's required. Organisations like the Healing Foundation Centre in Canberra, a wealth of knowledge and programs that look at addressing intergenerational trauma and healing our people in terms of history. Those types of responses alongside child protection responses was my point and what was needed to benefit Aboriginal people. Australia's come volumes and a long way as a society. Obviously, there's always, it's notable that there's room for improvement because of the status of Aboriginal people. But you look at the United Nations, and we have signed the United Nations Convention of Rights of the Child.
Yeah.
There's obligations in there that outline, you know, connection to culture. We're also, we've acknowledged but not a signatory to the Declaration of Indigenous Rights.
Yeah.
So those overarching documents can really give us a context to work with in terms of children and young people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people's rights within society, particularly when they're really vulnerable and there's a risk of cultural erosion from unintended impacts of out-of-home care. I also professionally draw upon the national mandate that we've been given. Around the past intrusive policies and practices, particularly the national apology in 2008 by the Prime Minister's Office to the stolen generations. And I think ultimately an extension of that is that within our roles and responsibilities in child protection, we do look at reconciliation from a viewpoint of healing intergenerational trauma and breaking that transfer of trauma and grief
to the
and
next generation,
grief and loss. Yes, absolutely. Mm. So, by balancing those approaches, it's hoped that we break that intergenerational trauma for future generations. There's some sections in the Act, Karen, that really protect our children, and have been designed since the 1970s. By Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander child protection professionals.
Yep.
One of those is the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander child placement principle.
Yep.
Which details clear obligations for placing with family, placing with community and language groups, and placing with Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people. to ensure that strong connection and identity development. It also outlines obligations where non-Aboriginal people are caring for our children to maintain a strong connection with family, including siblings, maintain that strong connection to culture, and that identity is actually enhanced and preserved whilst being in care. And so the ACCAs, or the Aboriginal Islander Child Care Agencies, were really the catalyst for positive change.
Mm-hmm.
And they drew on international knowledge in Canada and the US, particularly the Indian Welfare Act in the US, to implement and influence Australian child protection jurisdictions to adopt that child placement.
Because that's everywhere now in other states and territories, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been enshrined in legislation.
Mm.
I think there was, in 1986, there was agreement at the Australian Welfare Ministers Conference. And so from that policy commitment, states and territories embedded that in child protection legislation.
Well, with this review, is that principle safe?
Yes, I believe that the inquiry will see the benefit of these pieces of legislation. And I think that Section 83, the additional provisions for placing Aboriginal children, or the child placement principle, is an absolute in terms of the best interests and well-being of Aboriginal children. And I think that that's clearly understood. What's required is the strategies to enhance and improve engagement of community and engagement of family members to actually achieve better adherence. And we're all responsible for that, including community.
So do you need to change legislation to enable that, or is that something that, you know, is a process that is, you know, dealt with by government departments, by agencies themselves, rather than changing the Act?
At this stage, the department holds the statutory responsibility for actioning the child placement principle.
Mm-hmm.
There are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander foster and kinship care agencies. And also importantly, in Section 6 of the Act, there's a role that's outlined for the recognised entity, or Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander statutory support organisations. So ATSL's looking at some of the gaps in practice, can see quite clearly that a positive move forward would be to create more community ownership and to draw out family and community-based solutions. And looking at national jurisdictions, certainly in Victoria and New South Wales, Aboriginal professionals have more of a casework, hands-on assistance, where within Queensland, within the statutory, we've got a model which participates in decision-making and also provides advice and recommendations in consultation. Ideally, the sector is ready for a transfer of greater responsibility. And it's my view, with the appropriate business models, it can actually be performed more efficiently and more cost-effectively. So ATSLs will be looking at providing and informing the inquiry around possibilities of transferring greater responsibility to Aboriginal professionals, which will ultimately benefit with positive outcomes across the continuum for families, for children and young people.
Mm. So from an organisational point of view, is ATSL still giving evidence, as far as you know, or was that it, because you gave evidence as an individual, but also as part of the ATSL's team that went along to these hearings, yes?
Yeah, I was very supported by Shane Duffy, the CEO, and it was a difficult process because, yes, I am an employee of ATSL's, and we have important positions to put forward that benefit Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. But also I had that history of working in child protection.
Mm.
So I guess my statement had some independence in that regard, around the historical context of my work in child protection, but very much so the position around solutions in the future are a shared view within ATSLS. But like the Commission of Inquiry, we're still learning. Aboriginal way is to listen, to share, and to take on that knowledge. So we're also flexible in terms of looking at how Aboriginal professionals can be more effective, and look forward to the regional hearings and hearing from community. We have leave to appear, so we are sitting at the bench alongside other legal teams before the inquiry, and we have an opportunity to put in a written submission, which is the material there is available on the inquiry website. But also importantly, provide an overview or a case summary at the end of the inquiry.
Mm. I should just point out there, if there are people who are listening who are thinking of providing a submission or looking at attending those hearings where they are, I guess, public, you should check out the website, which is www.childprotectioninquiry.qld.gov.au. You'll be able to also look at the transcript of the hearings that have taken place thus far. I think that from memory they've gone up to hearings up until the 4th of this month. So that's childprotectioninquiry.qld.gov.au. Do you think very many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are taking much of an interest in this particular inquiry?
It's a great question, Karen.
Because, you know, the thing is, another inquiry, and they might do something about looking at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander issues.
Yeah.
There's that degree within the community, isn't there?
There's always a challenge of engaging and motivating the community, particularly where there's been a number of inquiries and no doubt hopes that the issue would be resolved in terms of intergenerational trauma and current overrepresentation. What's different about this inquiry is that the Newman government called this inquiry outside of a crisis, although the system is in crisis with the rates of overrepresentation. But it wasn't initiated because of a child death or a major incident. So it's positive in terms of the opportunity that the Commission of Inquiry has clearly identified overrepresentation and solution-focused strategies to address that in its terms of reference. So that's positive. What I would encourage communities to do is to provide a voice and take ownership of this issue, important issue. Children and young people are our future. And it's really important as a community that we stand up and support our most vulnerable and at-risk children. And the Commission of Inquiry has a number of ways that community can actually engage. And so I'd strongly suggest that if you are interested in providing information and a submission to the inquiry, that you contact one of their cultural advisors, and you can ring 1300 505603 and look at the processes that you can engage the inquiry. There's also some informal processes. Mm-hmm. The inquiry does have a range of support staff that can assist people to develop statements and their story. That could be as a parent, that could be as a fostering kinship carer, that could be as a former child in care. Importantly, I trust that Aboriginal organisations across the state will look at putting in submissions to inform best practice in child protection, particularly practices that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families, children and young people require for positive outcomes. So within that process, There is an informal approach where you wouldn't need to go before the inquiry as a witness publicly.
Mm-hmm.
That can be done informally through a witness statement and a meeting with the inquiry. So people don't have to be threatened. And I found
how did you find the experience?
Well, I obviously took to the stand and was a formal witness, but I actually found the inquiry quite accommodating, and I think that there's a respect for the importance that we hold addressing overrepresentation. So I actually felt that I was supported by all the parties with leave to appear through the process, and people were quite respectful. I did have to prepare and both professionally to speak at the inquiry, but also as an Aboriginal person, I had to find the right supports and people who were going to support me through that process, both emotionally and professionally.
Mm.
So what I'd encourage people to understand the importance, and that this communication with the inquiry will go a long way in terms of benefiting our children and young people, and the support's available there to assist people. ATSLS will be bringing forward a number of witnesses. We're in the process of finalising those statements now, and so we have had the capacity to support a number of elders, community organisations, foster and kinship carers, as well as a number of young people in developing those.
Mm.
Our capacity is limited, so I'd strongly recommend engaging the cultural advisors within the inquiry. And it's not anything to be frightened of or concerned, because, as I said, there's the informal processes that people can engage in to tell their story, and also the formal processes, such as the written submission that organisations may feel that's an appropriate avenue for them, or coming forward and being a witness.
And did you get a sense that they're keen to hear first-hand accounts, that the Commission is keen to hear from those individuals that have been caught up in the system?
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking to the cultural advisors, and then also my experience in the inquiry, is that the Commission and Council assisting, or the legal team assisting the Commission, and all the other stakeholders who have leave to appear, are very interested in addressing overrepresentation and are seeking to be informed by people with knowledge and experience that would be of value. So, you know, that definitely is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals who are working within this industry and who are well informed around possible solutions across the continuum of child protection. But it's also important that people such as extended family, elders, parents, foster and kinship carers, children and young people have an opportunity to tell their experience and what would have worked better for them as well. So that those people who may not feel comfortable fitting that category, say going up as a formal witness, can take the informal approach to inform the inquiry for the benefit of our children and young people. We have to take ownership and responsibility for our children, and ultimately they are our children, and it's important that we stand up and meet their care and protection needs across the board, across the state. It's so essential, Karen, that we unite and respectfully engage the inquiry and inform possible solutions to overrepresentation.
You're listening to Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service and on 98.9 FM. William Hayward is with us, the Law and Justice Advocacy Development Officer with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service. We're talking about the current inquiry into Queensland's child protection system. And this is Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service, broadcasting out of the studios of 98.9 FM in Brisbane. William Hayward is with me. My name's Karen Durante. William is with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service, and we've been talking about the Child Protection Inquiry that's being headed by Senior Counsel Tim Carmody, expected to report back to the Newnham government in late April 2013. And Will was just encouraging our mob to, you know, share their stories with the Commission of Inquiry in a number of ways that Will discussed. You can do that. Here's some information about where you can access further details about the inquiry. There's the Child Protection Inquiry website, which is simply childprotectioninquiry.qld.gov.au, or you can call a cultural advisor on 1300 505603 if you're wanting to contribute to that inquiry. Just in closing, William, ATSLs are hosting a child's rights advocate, as I understand it, a First Nations woman from Canada.
Yeah, that's right, Karen. Given the importance of the inquiry and moving forward with innovative programs that assist Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, young people and families with the right services at the right time, as part of our submission process to the inquiry, we've been blessed with an opportunity to meet with a leading international child's rights advocate, Cindy Blackstock. Cindy works for the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada and is very instrumental across First Nations child protection. Cindy's visited Australia on a number of occasions and informed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals across the nation. So we'll be really interested in engaging Cindy around our submission, particularly looking at where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals can have more practical assistance and casework type roles within the statutory system. It's clear that models where Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have responsibility over child protection, that it does achieve more beneficial results in terms of engagement and the outcomes that benefit children and young people from that appropriate engagement within the statutory. So it's very exciting, and we look forward to that meeting on Monday.
And how long is she in town for?
I believe Cindy has a range of commitments, so I think she'll be here for a number of weeks. But we're lucky enough to have Cindy for a number of hours in a morning meeting. So it'll be great to get her position and views around how we could move forward and better resource Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander professionals to have a defining impact in addressing over-representation. And I think we can honestly say with integrity that Aboriginal professionals at this stage in child protection history are ready to take on more responsibility. And in Canada, there's a range of models. The model that we're probably interested in which we think is transferable to a degree, is the partial delegation model. So some actions can be delegated out to the non-government sector, in this case Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations, to deliver some core Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander practices such as cultural retention and preservation activities and case work and case planning, but also really importantly areas like the family group meeting, so where the family meets with the department. We're exploring whether it's more appropriate that an independent Aboriginal convener would be better placed to facilitate family responses and community solutions.
Do we have the capacity to deliver that kind of model, or do we need sort of, you know, do organisations, and do we need more people in that field?
We would need to look at the model of the recognised entity and look at how that can be innovatively adapted to be more hands-on assistance within the statutory. The capacity is definitely there. There would need to be training and upskilling and a transfer into the new approach. But all of that is easily overcome through appropriate business models and leadership. And as I said, I from my experience in the sector, we are actually ready to take on more responsibility. And ultimately, we've seen a system that has failed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And I strongly assert that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community and their agencies can actually achieve better results more efficiently and cost effectively. Again, I think that there will always be some statutory power that should be appropriately held by the state and in this case, Child Safety Services. But we're really seeking and exploring as part of this process the opportunities that are there for Aboriginal professionals to have more of a defining impact in children's lives.
Well, Will, we are up against time, so we appreciate you coming in to have a chat with us about your thoughts on the child protection system and also about this commission of inquiry, as we mentioned before, due to wrap up, well, at least provide a written report to the government, to the Premier by the 30th of April next year. So I guess we look forward to what the outcomes will be. Will, thank you very much.
Thank you, Karen. And I wait optimistically for the outcome. And again, I encourage the community to engage the Commission of Inquiry so that the people at the table there are well informed by our community.
William Hayward, Law and Justice Advocacy Development Officer with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service. Well, that is Let's Talk for today and for this week.